Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I'm so glad you can join me for a few minutes today as we look back through the big old binder of baseball cards and go trucking through the 1960s. And we are right in the thick of some of the best cards made by Topps, the early to mid-60s era. In particular, 1962 to 65. This week, we're looking at 1964. If you will, the weakest link in this great era, but still a very solid design and some very memorable cards. And a very memorable player is our random pull, card number 109, Le Grand Orange, as he was known many years later in Montreal. But here, he was just a Topps All-Star rookie, talking about Rusty Staub of the Houston Colt 45s. Yes, pre-Houston Astros, the Colt 45s, a great little history with them and their dilapidated frying pan of a stadium, and a great career for Rusty Staub that could have been a lot greater had it not been for injuries. He really battled through primarily hand and wrist injuries for the final 8 to 10 years of his career. And he still put up some pretty solid numbers for a guy who was battling it for a very long time. But we'll talk about Rusty Staub, the Colt 45s, and the 64 top set after we talk about what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, open 24/7. Always looking forward to your conversations there, whether you're talking about our podcast, the players we discuss, the sets that we talk about, or just anything in the hobby. Got a few things to share with you from this past week, starting with our friend Dub Mentality. Posted a blog post from his website, dubmentality.com, and I advise you check it out. In fact, we have retweeted it. And it's about a group of cards that he found in his collection. And one of them kind of follows along my doctrine that any vintage cards in any condition, buy them. It's not a bad investment just to at least have them on hand. And a lot of the cards that were in this collection that he shared with us, were fairly new cards, but there was one in particular that is definitely not. It is a 1955 Bowman Mickey Mantle card. And it has been through the ringer a few times, and perhaps literally through a ringer. But he mentions that he's been meaning to share that Mantle card with us since we started talking about vintage sets and talking about condition being a non-factor. And he says, I didn't care if it was in four pieces. It's almost in four pieces. But this is, again, a great example of, you know, if you were to buy this Mantle card from a card shop in this condition, it's probably still going to cost you like $40 or $50. But you have a 55 Bowman Mickey Mantle, and it doesn't even look like Mantle. That's the funny thing. He is so young in this picture. It doesn't look like him. Actually, it's a painting of a picture. That was common practice for baseball card companies back in the 50s. They would take actual photographs and then paint them up, and you had basically a piece of artwork. And of course, the 55 Bowman set, as we mentioned in the last podcast, with the wood grain television display case setting, really makes it look like a piece of art here. But I also like, too, this picture, the painting that was inspired by the picture was taken in Shibe Park. You could tell because of the big outfield wall in right field. And this would have been one of the last pictures of Shibe Park, at least in terms of American League players, because the previous season was the final season for the Athletics in Philadelphia. In 1955, they had moved to Kansas City. So you got all sorts of history here. You got Mantle, you got Shibe Park, you've got the Yankees in their glory days, 55 Bowman set here. And yeah, it may be in many pieces, but you know what? Joey, you've got a 55 Bowman Mickey Mantle. And that's all there is to it. It's kind of like our random pull from the 62 top set, Tim McCarver. I've got a Tim McCarver rookie. Okay, it's probably book value $4 because it's been folded in half twice. But, hey, you know, I've got a 62 Topps card. Just happens to be Tim McCarver's rookie card, and I really enjoy it. And one last thought on the condition being a non-factor of some of these older cards. You can get them on eBay, like I mentioned in the previous episode. You can buy a lot of these cards from the 1960s, even the 1950s, for relatively decent price if you're not concerned about condition. But you can also, if you go to the right local card shop, you can find one that's in decent shape for just a pennies on the dollar because of the condition. And I actually recently found a baseball card shop here in Tampa. I couldn't tell you the last time I found a local card shop. It's probably been 8 or 10 years because they're certainly not as frequent as they were when we were kids collecting. But I found one purely by accident. I went to get dinner one night at a kind of a fast casual restaurant and saw there was a strip mall next to the restaurant and, you know, those signs outside the strip mall with, you know, 8 or 10 businesses on it and one set baseball cards. I'm like, wait a minute, there's a baseball card shop here? And apparently it's been there for a while. So one day I walk in and I'm just looking around and nothing was really, you know, blowing my socks off. But then I saw on a table, there was this monster box filled with a whole bunch of cards from the 70s. And I asked the guy, I said, how much are these going for? He's just like, oh, just pull out what you want and we'll come up with something. And long story short, I took home a lot of about 320, 330, mostly 78 tops, but there's some from, I'd say, 77, 76, a few from 72, quite a few beaten up, but most of them I would say are in, you know, excellent condition. A lot of them are common cards, but there are some star cards in there. Like I know there's a Jack Clark card in there. There's a Steve Carlton card. Even though I bought this a couple weeks ago, I haven't really had time to thumb through the whole box. But, you know, we came to an agreement, you know, these 320, 330 cards, $20 out the door. And, you know, you can't beat that. And like I said, you know, in the grand scheme of things, maybe the collection of cards is worth $20. It's probably more. But, you know, I get to at some point go through this random box of cards and, you know, look through some hilarious cards from the 70s, maybe some good cards, some star cards and young rookie cards as well. And that's just something that I look forward to. So, again, if you don't let the condition of some of these older cards hold you back, I say go at it. For many of you, this may be the first time you've ever handled cards from the 50s and 60s. And like I said, even though they're beaten up, you get a feel for some of these older cards, the design of the older cards, but also the history of the teams, the players. You get something that you can't get, even though Topps especially is really big into the recreation of these cards. You know, the Topps Heritage Series and the Archive Series in particular, where they, you know, basically dig up the templates of the old cards and put today's players on them. That's neat, but to actually have the original card in your hand, in my opinion, is even neater. Eric Eller sending us a picture of a Harmon Killebrew 62 tops. It's one of those three-panel action shot cards, and it says Killebrew sends one into orbit, which he was very common to do back in the day. And here he is. It's basically three pictures of him going through the motions of his swing. And I should add that it looks like this picture has been touched up a little bit too. It's not necessarily a straight photograph. It might be touched up with a little bit of paint just to add a little drama to it. But it's three pictures of Killebrew going through his swing. And Eric says, just finished 1962 Topps episode. All-time favorite card is Killebrew number 316. Framed one and put it in my son's room. And that is a great prize for your son. First of all, you've got this, again, you know, 62 Topps card here. Just scanning at the picture here, is it in mint condition? No, but it's in pretty darn good condition from what I can see. And he's got it nice framed, matted, and that is just a really neat touch for your kids. So, Eric, good on you. I don't see, it doesn't say on your profile where you're from, but I'm assuming you're a Twins fan or just a Harmon Killebrew fan, but that's a great thing that you can pass down to your children. So great job, Eric, and thank you so much for sharing that. Some commentary on our 63 Topps episode from Ted Ziegler, noting that our random poll, Frank Howard's nickname while with Washington was the Capital Punisher. How great was that? Absolutely. That's one of the best nicknames. And I don't know if you can, you know, rightly put that on somebody like Bryce Harper now with the Nationals. I think that's the name that should always stick with Frank Howard, but it's my opinion there. But it's such a great nickname, and, you know, for some very, very, very bad Washington Senators teams, especially in the 1960s, Frank Howard was the one guy that the other teams had to pitch around and at least game plan for. Everybody else, not so much. And our buddy in Buffalo, Wax Pack 916, talking about the expansion discussion we had in the 62 Tops episode a couple weeks ago, but also a little bit on 63 Tops. He said that he found the episodes interesting, was unaware of Buffalo's role in possible expansion. I knew about their efforts in 92. Well, yeah, Buffalo was one of those cities. And of course, you live up there, and I used to live not in Buffalo, but nearby in Rochester when I was very, very young. And the city of Buffalo was still a city that was not only big, but continuing, I wouldn't say to grow, but was still a very integral part in the American economy in the late 50s and early 60s. But I'm kind of surprised that they even put in an expansion effort in the early 90s, because clearly by then things were starting to go downhill in Western New York. That's the whole reason why my dad, who is an engineer, we moved in 1980 to Florida, because the building work was not happening in Western New York in 1980. It was happening down here in the Sunshine State. But I did let Waxpack 916 know that we're really going to get into some expansion history when we get to the 69 Tops set in a few weeks, because 69 Tops, not one of my favorite sets, because it had a lot of the hangups that the 61 Tops set had, especially when it came to expansion. There were just some things that Tops could not really do as they waited not just for two new teams to come in, but four. But that was really Major League Baseball's fault that four expansion teams started at the same time, really throwing a curveball in Tops plans for the 1969 set. But we're not just going to blame Major League Baseball. It almost always comes down to Charlie Finley, and we'll get into the details of that. But when Charles Finley moved the A's out of Kansas City to Oakland in 1968, that got the ball rolling for the very over-aggressive expansion of 1969. So we'll share some thoughts on that again in a few weeks. Now, again, you can share your thoughts at any time at Wax and Gum Stains, our official Twitter feed. Talk about our players that we talk about, the sets that we talk about, the podcast, or anything in the hobby, anything in your old collection, anything you stumble upon, or just memories about some of the sets that we talk about. You can do that again at Wax and Gum Stains. And of course, if you're new to Wax Ecstatic, we have new episodes every Tuesday. We post them at 10 a.m. Eastern on Tuesdays. We're going through the big old binder of cards from 1954 to 1980. Prior to this, we went through the big old monster box of all the sets, a lot of them from the junk wax era, but still a lot of great memories from 1981 to 1993. And you can listen to our new episodes and archived episodes various ways. Audio Boom is our home base, if you will. So audioboom.com or the Audio Boom app. But also, you can check out new and older shows via iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and TuneIn. So whatever your preferred delivery method of our program is, we've got it for you. New episodes on Tuesdays, and we have our Flashback Friday episodes throughout the summer. This past weekend, one of my favorite sets from 1984, and 84 was a great year for baseball cards. 84 Donruss, the year that Donruss finally got it right. Ron Kittle was our random pull, and there are still a lot of collectors all these years later who lament opening up the sets from 1983 for the Ron Kittle rookie cards and kind of casting aside the Tony Gwynns and the Wade Boggs and the Ryan Sandbergs. So we had a lot of fun with that. So check that out. That's one of many archived episodes. Again, Audio Boom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, or Stitcher. Now let's take a look at 64 Tops, as Rusty Staub is our random pull, card number 109. And we'll talk a little bit about Rusty and the Colt 45s, or as it's mentioned on this card, the Colts. Tops didn't have enough room to cram the whole name of the team up there. But this is, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, This is the one set, if you set aside 62 through 65 tops, which again, in my opinion, is one of the best stretches of creativity and rookie cards and star cards and baseball card history. The 62 through 65 window is pretty solid. The weakest link of those four sets is 64 tops. And for many, many years, I don't want to say I wasn't a big fan of 64 tops, but I didn't go out of my way to get 64 tops. And this was an issue that started with me many, many years ago. I want to say like 26, 27, 28 years ago, when I was going to the local flea market and buying these older cards. And I mentioned in our last podcast, that's where the 63 tops Frank Howard came from. This isn't where the Rusty Staub came from. I believe I got this in a lot of 60s cards I bought off eBay a year or two ago. But when I first got my hands on some of these older 1960s cards when I was a teenager, I looked at them. And 64 tops was neat, but it just didn't like go blow me away. It's just not one of those sets where you go, wow, this is really cool. But over time, I've grown to appreciate it because of two reasons. One, I'm a huge fan of the TV show Mad Men. And I've even referenced Mad Men several times in some of our previous podcasts, in particular 58 and 59 tops, where I've noticed that there was a little bit of a Madison Avenue feel to the design of the cards. And I can honestly say I watched Mad Men every episode, every week. I watched it live every week. You know, some people are binging on the series now, but I'm one of those hardy people that was there on day one, episode one, and watched it all the way through. And it's just a phenomenal TV series. But, because I have that respect for Mad Men and kind of the marketing and advertising look, feel, sensation of the 1960s, the more I look at 64 tops, the more I realize this really captured the look and the feel of 1964. Now, I wasn't alive in 1964, so I'm only, forming this opinion based on many, 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 many things that I've seen, read, heard. There's a certain design to each year and each generation in American pop culture. And I really think when you look at, advertising back then, you think of the World's Fair, you think of the big presidential election with Lyndon Johnson and Barry Goldwater. When you think of, network television really roaring to life at this point in time, when you pull in all of these factors here and you look at a 64 tops card, I look at it and I go, that really, it looks like 1964. And it just seems to really represent the time, even though in an aesthetic sense, it's not as good as the 62 or 63 tops. I think 64 holds its own. Now, the other reason why I appreciate it, and it's kind of funny because I was just talking about Topps Heritage cards. It's neat to have a design with current players, an old design with current players. And I've said it before, I love the 68 Topps Heritage, or I should say 2017 Topps Heritage, which is designed like 68 Topps. But, about a year ago, again, another eBay find. I go to eBay, look up Topps Heritage packs. I was just in the Topps Heritage purchasing mode. And lo and behold, somebody had, I think, like 10 packs of Topps Heritage. Let's see, what year would it have been? 2013 for something like $20. I mean, it's a pretty decent deal. So I buy the packs, I rip through them. I hadn't really completely come back to collecting in 2013. So this was really my first time of going through the 2013 Topps Heritage sets. And they used the 64 Topps template, and they really made the cards look sharp. So, it took me only about, 25, 26, 27 years to finally come around. I don't love 64 tops, but I really have grown to like the design now. Now, a lot of collectors don't like the design, and mostly because of the front of the design. The biggest complaint is that there is too much space taken up by the team name and the player name. And in fact, in the case of this Rusty Staub card, the ginormous All-Star Rookie Trophy that Topps had started putting on some of their prospect cards earlier in the decade. Of course, you have the usual problems with baseball cards from back then, and that is that the white borders would yellow a little bit over time. The cards were often miscut. Again, evident here in this Rusty Staub card as it's leaning a little to the right, not completely cut off, but clearly off center. And I can understand why some people don't like that. There is a lot of space taken up with the team name at the top. There is quite a bit of space, although no more than what you saw in 63 Tops. In fact, there's actually less space taken up by the player's name and position here. But, you know, it does kind of shrink the picture frame a little bit. And considering how much space was given to the player picture in 63, 62, 61, and 60, I can understand why some people don't like that particular design. So I get it. I'm not necessarily in that boat, but I completely understand why you may not like it. Now, I'm sure completely unplanned, Topps would utilize that large space for the team name by having players' heads kind of pop out above the picture frame. So this goes back to what we discussed with what Fleer was doing in the mid to late 80s, starting with the 87 set, and having the player photographs kind of have this 3D element to where they stuck out or kind of meshed in with the background or the top frame of the card. And you could see it here with Rusty Staub. You know, his hat is kind of poking out above the frame here. So it was some pretty neat cropping by the Topps company to make it seem like Rusty Staub is jumping out at you. Now, another popular card that has this kind of feature to it is the Pete Rose card. Now, this is not Pete Rose's rookie card. His rookie card is in the 1963 set, but this is the first card where Rose is pictured by himself, because 63 Tops, you had the four pictures of players around the card. So the Pete Rose rookie card, the second year card for Pete Rose, I should say, which is very popular in the 64 Topps set, valued around $1,000, depending on where you buy it at. The picture of Pete at the batting cage at Al Lopez Field in Tampa. Oh, by the way, his head is popping up just a little bit over the upper border of the picture. Now, this type of card, while it's kind of neat that they were doing this 3D look to it, understandably, some collectors don't like it, because when the player's head is kind of popping out, it also tends to blend in with the name of the team up top. And in fact, with the Pete Rose card, because the Reds had a white cap, white with red pinstripe cap back in 1963 when the picture was taken, it blends in with the white background with the red. So some cards didn't quite pull it off real well. Others did. For example, Bill Mazeroski, I've seen a picture of a card of his from 1964 where he's in a batting stance and, his head's kind of cocked a little bit to the side and, it's kind of floating out there. And that's kind of neat when you see that. Another big card from 64 Topps is Phil Niekro's rookie card. That's a card that he shares with Phil Roof, a catcher for the Milwaukee Braves. So much like the Rose card from the year before, you've got multiple players on the card. But as we'll discuss when we get to 68 Topps and Nolan Ryan, that's not the only time that a major rookie was featured along somebody that didn't quite get the same amount of billing in his career. But, the 64 Topps set, that's why some people don't like it, because of the big letters and the big team name at the top of the card. And again, the player picture kind of blending in with it. I actually like it. And again, to me, it just kind of represents, it looks like 1964. And I think even though there's a lot more border space for this compared to some previous sets, I don't think it's bad. I mean, it's not, again, you look at the set, you don't go, wow, but it's not one of those sets where you go, ooh, this is terrible. So there are going to be some naysayers. There are going to be some people that don't like it, or they're going to be people like me who didn't like it at first, but slowly came around. But again, the 64 Topps set is not one that is universally loved, like 63 Tops or several other sets there. So it's a mixed bag. I wouldn't necessarily say you like it or you don't, because I think as opposed to some other sets, there is a little gray area here. But you're going to see a lot more people leaning towards the kind of feeling than the wow feeling. But as we look at this particular card with Rusty Staub, you've got Staub striking a pose. Looks like it is in the Polo Grounds. I believe that's a Mets player in the background there. And that would not be a surprise. Tops had a lot of their photographers. They would have one stationed on the East Coast, typically in New York and or Washington. And then one on the West Coast, typically in Los Angeles and or San Francisco. And that's where the pictures of a lot of players were taken there. You've got Colts in big old orange letters at the top. You have his name and position at the bottom, the big honkin' rookie trophy in the corner, and the classic Colt 45 hat there, as Rusty Staub was just beginning his major league career here. Flip the card over. Here's one of the things I like about 64 Tops, even though it's hard to tell, particularly with this card, because it is old and faded. But if you can find a 64 Tops card with a good back to it, you will see that there's this kind of orangish red background. Like I said, this one is faded, but you've got the card number in the upper left-hand corner, player's name and personal information along the top, the complete major and minor league batting record. Now, in the case of Rusty Staub, he didn't really have much of one because he played a little bit in the minor leagues and made the jump to the major leagues at just 19 years old in 1962. So you have a couple lines of stats here, actually three lines, so two lines for his experience in Durham and then Houston, and then you've got the major league totals, and then you've got quite a bit of narrative there at the top half of the card, although for most players, you'll see a lot more space dedicated to stats and a lot less space to storytelling. Now, one of the neat things about the backs of the 64 Tops cards was the little trivia section. You had an area at the bottom of the card that had the answer to a trivia question, and you were supposed to take a coin and rub the little silver etchings off to find the answer. Of course, this is nightmarish for collectors because that means some kids over 50 years ago were just damaging the hell out of their cards by scraping the back of these cards here. So that is another reason why some collectors don't like it, because you can very rarely find these in gem mint condition. But a lot of these cards, because they are over 50 years old, the silver part has flaked off and the text underneath it has also faded away here. So you've got 64 Tops cards in a lot of various conditions here, but it is kind of neat. It's something that Tops employed with their hockey set in 1980, where in order to find out the name of the player on the front of the card, you had to scratch the name off on the front. So there's different pricing for the 80-81 Topps cards with the player's name revealed and without the player's name revealed. I haven't seen anything official with 64 Topps with the scratch off on the back, but very few still have the metallic covering on it. So it's pretty much just accepted that that has been scratched off at some point in time. And really the condition of the card is based on how hard did the person scratch off that trivia answer? Did it wear through the front of the card, or was it able to keep the card intact? So looking back at the card itself, 64 Tops, it's not a great design, but I think it's a good design. And again, I think one of the big reasons why it still holds its own all these years later is, you know, by 1964 design, and I'm thinking of advertising, I'm thinking of marketing, I'm thinking of engineering, I'm thinking of a lot of things. 1964 was still a very, I don't want to say conservative, but a lot of straight lines, Frank Lloyd Wright, construction, you know, it was cold, it was serious, it was straight lines, it was in the middle of the Cold War. This is before the explosion of, you know, the summer of love and flower power and all that stuff, just a few years later. And this is also after the big, vibrant 1950s going into the early 60s. There was a lot of cold, straight, nothing crazy in terms of design back then. And I think it still kind of, you know, holds that feeling now when you look at the design of it. So it's not a winner for a lot of collectors, but again, over time, I came around to appreciate it, and I still like it. It would be upstaged the following year with one of my favorite sets of all time, 65 Tops, but 64 Tops, I think, holds its own. Great selection of stars in particular. Like I said, the rookies, not as big as some previous sets, but you get that second year Pete Rose card. You've got the Phil Niekro rookie card. You've got youngsters like Rusty Staub here. So you've got a pretty good assortment of cards here in a 7-series set that also featured a couple of interesting things. One, a metal coin in each pack. So you have 164 coins that are another fun collectible for people to try to gather together. Also, a pretty unique card, a memorial card for Ken Hubbs, who died in a plane crash prior to the 1964 season. So that's pretty unique there. I do recall, you know, Topps had a memorial card for Bart Giamatti in the 1990 set. Of course, he died just months after taking over the commissioner's role, in 1989. So it's not often that you saw cards like that, but it's pretty neat. And like I said, you've got good star power here. Overall, a decent design. It's still a winner in my mind. And I think because this is one of those sets that's not heavily sought after by collectors, if you're somebody that just wants to grow your set and if you want a vintage set, 64 Tops, I think, is a pretty good one. Go on eBay, go to, you know, other card dealers online or your local card shop. I bet you can find a stack of these and they will sell them to you for, you know, a quarter a piece or 50 cents a piece or something like that. And you'll have a nice little collection with a handful of decent cards from 1964. Now, as for Rusty Staub, like I mentioned, he made his major league debut in 1963. He was 19 years old. He was only the second major league rookie in the 20th century to play 150 games as a teenager. The first was Bob Kennedy of the Chicago White Sox. He was also 19 years old at that time. But even though Topps had tabbed Rusty Staub as an all-rookie for the 1963 season and things were looking good, Staub really struggled in Houston in 1964, played only 89 games, and had a batting average of .216, 8 home runs, 35 RBI. And while there was a pretty interesting youth movement in the early days of the Houston Colt 45s, later the Astros, Rusty Staub was not able to really find his footing. So he spent a lot more time in the minors than he did in the majors. However, come 1965, the team moves indoors. They're rebranded the Houston Astros. Rusty Staub starts to find his groove. 131 games played, a .256 batting average, 14 home runs, and then his career started taking off there. One of his best seasons, in fact, the first of 5 consecutive All-Star seasons, 1967, Rusty Staub had 44 doubles, 10 home runs, a .333 batting average, and he was in the MVP race in 1967, a distant 16th, but still, as far as I'm concerned, if you're playing well enough to be considered in the top 20 of voting, then that's definitely a good thing. And I think Rusty Staub's speed is something that gets lost in time. This guy had some pretty good power, and he had some wheels early on. You don't think of Rusty Staub as being a guy that could just whip around the bases. He was officially listed as 6'2", 190 pounds. So that's big, but not huge, but certainly not like Luis Aparicio small. So Rusty Staub's speed is something that, especially early on in his career, a lot of people forget about. And he was a big extra base guy for Houston for the next couple of years. You know, 37 doubles in 1968, 6 home runs, but he also had a triple, and he would get a lot of triples later on in his career. So a lot of people think mostly of the power hitting that he had, and he did get some pretty good power, especially in Montreal later on in his career. But his speed is something that often gets left by the wayside, which is unfortunate. Now, as I mentioned, with Montreal, he was traded from Houston to the Expos for Jesus Alou, Don Clendenin, And the Expos had to kind of make up this deal here because Clendenin did not want to go to Houston. So the Expos later on would send Jack Billingham, Skip Gwynn, and $100,000 to Houston to complete the trade at the very beginning of the 1969 season. Well, this is where Rusty Staub really catches on. Granted, he was a fan favorite in Houston, and again, he was a fast guy. He was a good fielder. He was an all-star in 1967 and 68, but he really endeared himself to the new major league fans in Montreal, not only continuing that 5 years of all-star appearances. He was an all-star in 69, 70, and 71, but you know, you had the bright red hair, you had the speed, you had the bat, and he would really take advantage of that jet stream effect that was in Jarry Park, the one that would take a fly ball and just sail it into the swimming pool beyond the right field fence. Rusty Staub was a left-handed batter, so once he cranked one, if it got into that jet stream, it was more than likely ending up in that Civic swimming pool, which is still there. By the way, Jarry Park is now a tennis park, not just the main stadium where the Expos play, but the entire area is a tennis complex. But the swimming pool that you see in pictures beyond the right field fence, that was, that was a favorite landing spot for a lot of hard hit home runs, and it is still there. So he took advantage of that, had 29 home runs in 69, 30 home runs in 70, and in 1971, he had 19 home runs, but again, was still cranking out doubles and triples and was on average hitting about 280, 285. Well, the big reason why the Montreal fans loved him is Rusty Staub, when he got up there, said, "I'm going to learn how to speak your language," and he learned how to speak French. And let me tell you, as somebody who works in the world of hockey, if you find yourself working in the city of Montreal or the province of Quebec, if you go up there and say, "I'm going to learn your language," you will be loved. Brian Gianta, who is now with the Buffalo Sabres, a few years ago, he was the captain of the Canadiens. And even though he's U.S. born, he went out of his way to speak the language. Randy Cunnyworth, who was very briefly the head coach of the Canadiens a few years back, was kind of put in a very bad situation because he was not francophone, because he was not bilingual and did not speak French. The first thing he said was, "I'm going to learn how to speak French. My family's going to learn how to speak French." Now, things long-term didn't work out for him up there, but he got quite a bit of respect from the Montreal fans that he wasn't just there to clock in and clock out. He was going to try to integrate himself into the culture and not just the job position. Well, Rusty Staub does that, and of course, the Expos fans love him, and that is where he got the nickname Le Grand Orange, which is, of course, the Big Orange. Well, after the 1971 season, Le Grand Orange makes his exit from Montreal to the New York Mets, where another fan base would absolutely love him. Right before the start of the 72 season, Tim Foley, Mike Jorgensen, and Ken Singleton go to Montreal, and Rusty Staub becomes a star in Shea Stadium. However, it started with a lot of injuries, and it was a rather unfortunate hit-by-pitch situation in the middle of the 1972 season where Staub broke his wrist, his right wrist, and after he was hit by this pitch, he fought through it, but then eventually at the end of the season needed surgery. And, of course, surgery on wrist in 1972, not quite as fluid as nowadays. You know, if you have wrist surgery, it's no walk in the park, but you know, you can get it. It's almost outpatient surgery nowadays. Well, in 1972, it wasn't. And beginning with the 1973 season, that wrist injury would hamper Rusty Staub for the rest of his career. Not immediately, but certainly when he was older, his availability to do certain things, his career stats dropped off because as he got older and you're dealing with the usual growing pains and arthritis that somebody in their mid-30s or, early 40s deals with, having to deal with this constant pain in his wrist really affected his play. But, he was a star of the amazing Mets of 1973, 152 games played, .279 batting average, still managed to muscle 15 home runs, 36 doubles, and got the Mets to the World Series where they would lose to Oakland. But considering how shoddy of a regular season the Mets had in 73, it was amazing that they got up there. He was a fan favorite in New York, and after the 1975 season, he was on the move once again, this time going to the Motor City, as he's traded to the Detroit Tigers along with teammate Bill Laxton for Billy Baldwin and the aging lefty Mickey Lolick. Now in Detroit, he turns his career into the designated hitter career. In fact, Rusty Staub was the first player to play an entire season at DH. So the previous three seasons, you had guys that were kind of in and out of the lineup. Well, because of the wrist injury, because he was starting to put on weight and slow down a little bit, the Tigers didn't want to put him out on the field all the time. So 1976, his first full season with the Tigers, he's an all-star. Once again, 161 games played, a .299 batting average, 15 home runs, 28 doubles, and he makes a nice little career in Detroit before he starts bouncing around throughout the latter years of his career. July 1979, traded back to the Montreal Expos. Right before the 1980 season, he's traded by the Expos to Texas. Granted free agency twice, he comes back to sign with the New York Mets in the late 1980s, and he would end his major league career at the age of 41 in 1985. All in all, for Rusty Staub, 23 years in the major leagues. He also had 292 home runs, 1,466 RBI, 499 doubles, 47 triples, and a grand total of 2,716 hits. Now, unfortunately for Rusty, he was never a member of the World Series championship team. He did play in that one World Series in 1973, but he really laid the foundation with a lot of fan bases back in the day, certainly starting with Houston in 1963, actually, was his rookie year. Moving on to Montreal in 1969, really made a name for himself with the New York Mets because of his hustle and his personality, and then was able to return the favor, coming back to Montreal and New York many, many years later. Did not get into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Unfortunately, never garnered more than 7.9% of the vote. Was actually dropped from the ballot in 1997. And again, this is where the injuries really hurt him over the years. That wrist injury probably could have, you know, especially in a designated hitter role, he probably would have been able to make something a little more of his time in the big leagues, you know, in the late 70s and early 80s, but that unfortunately not the case. Now, what is Rusty Staub up to nowadays? Well, he is still an ambassador for the Mets. The Montreal Expos, by the way, retired his number 10 back in 1993. And this guy is amazing because he's a New Orleans native. He's getting up there in years. He just recently turned 73 years old. And a couple years ago, he suffered a heart attack while on a flight from Ireland to New York. It was a bad enough situation where the pilot had to turn around, so he goes back to Ireland. And he had to fly in a special flight back to New York a few days later as he recovered. It was a flight that was going to cost $60,000. Well, fans were able to raise that money. And he was able to get back in New York on time to throw out the opening pitch. I believe it was game three of the 2015 World Series between the Mets and the Royals. So Rusty Staub is still a beast. You know, Le Grand Orange lives and fights another day, fighting off a heart attack on a transatlantic flight and still able to pull it all together just a few days later, throw out the opening pitch at Citi Field. Now, a couple other quick thoughts about the Houston Colt 45s. I'm sure this won't be the last Houston Astro card that we look at or player we look at. In fact, we had a lot of Astros and some of our junk wax cards because they had so many good young players. I know we did Craig Biggio in one of the episodes, but the Colt 45s, I love the history of the Houston Colt 45s, who later became the Astros, because this isn't like the Seattle Pilots where they just had 1 year and then vanished. The Houston Colt 45s had one of the greatest logos, even though I'm all about, you know, hoping this nation one day stops shooting everybody up. The Colt revolver. or as they say, the gun that won the West. That was the primary logo. And, you know, you had the gun and the smoke coming out of the gun formed the letter C for Colt 45s. Of course, they were known as the Colts in shorthand. The hats had the .45S on it. They had a minor league team called the Colt 22s. So you had the .22S as their logo and as their hat. That was kind of neat there. But you've heard me talk about the history of the expansion in 1961 and 1962. The Houston story, let me just give you a little bit about that. That, too, was part of the threatening Continental Baseball League that Branch Rickey was pushing in the late 1950s. And the city of Houston has actually had a very, very long history of baseball. It goes back to the 1880s. The Houston Buffaloes, or the Buffs, as they were known, a very popular minor league team in Houston, Texas, for decades. Well, they were lobbying to get a team. The St. Louis Cardinals almost moved there in the early 50s. If you listen to our 1954 Tops podcast, I tell you the story about how Bill Veeck was hoping, as the owner of the St. Louis Browns, he could push the Cardinals out. And it almost happened because the Cardinals' ownership at the time was in serious trouble with the IRS. And then Augie Bush comes in and that changed things. But just imagine, had the Cardinals not been able to land Augie Bush as their owner, the Cardinals could have moved on to Houston, and the Cardinals would have been dead. You would have had the Houston Buffaloes in all likelihood. The St. Louis Browns would be the existing major league team in St. Louis, and the Baltimore Orioles may not exist, or maybe some other team would have eventually landed there. But the Houston people, after the failed relocation attempt of the Cardinals, they decided, okay, let's get together, let's do a professional push here for this team. And they spent several years trying to get a team to move there. They tried to get the Continental Baseball League there. Of course, the Continental League fell apart once the National League agreed to expand. And the National League said, okay, we will expand to New York and Houston. Now, the people in Houston wanted to name the new team the Buffaloes, but there was a big legal battle between the Buffaloes ownership and the group that had landed the expansion team. So they had a name the team contest. The Colt 45s were born, and basically the team that owned the expansion franchise bought out the Buffaloes. Even though they couldn't get the naming rights, they basically bought the team. And a lot of the people that worked for the team, including some coaches, were able to just basically move into the major leagues in 1962. Not all that different from what happened when the Atlanta Thrashers in the NHL moved to Winnipeg. There was a minor league team in Winnipeg called the Manitoba Moose. And there's a Manitoba Moose team now, but this was a different Manitoba Moose. They basically just graduated from the AHL to the NHL. Exact same thing happened in Houston in 1962. So the Colt 45s are born, and one of the legendary stories of the Colt 45s, the Houston Astros early days before the Astrodome, yes, Colt Stadium, which was this giant wooden bleacher mosquito fest in what is now the parking lot of Reliance Center. Basically, Reliance Stadium is almost built where Colt Stadium was. It was across the parking lot from the Astrodome and what was eventually Astro World that was built on the other side. But Colt Stadium was, I think, like a 32,000-seat stadium. It was wide open. There was no shelter. There was no cover. So if you didn't bake in the sunshine and the God-forbidden heat and humidity of Houston, Texas in the summer, then the mosquitoes that were roughly the size of the state of Texas would pick you up and carry you away. Colt Stadium was the only stadium that had the unique fan-friendly mosquito spray. They would actually, during middle innings, you would have mosquito trucks just go out and douse the crowd with all sorts of chemicals to try to keep the mosquitoes away. So you can see why the Astrodome, which of course now is seen as a bygone relic of 1960s architecture, why the Astrodome was so needed, because the heat, the humidity, the thunderstorms when they came through, and most notably the mosquitoes, made watching baseball in Houston a very, very bad thing. Now, of course, the Astrodome, which when it was first built was called the Harris County Domed Stadium, when that was put into place for construction in 1962. So they knew it was going to be built before they, you know, threw out the first pitch at Colt Stadium. But the Houston baseball fans had to put up with a nightmare of a fan experience with the mosquitoes and the weather for three full seasons before they moved indoors. Now, of course, the team changed its name to the Astros to reflect the more futuristic connection of Houston and science and technology, and in particular with NASA having a home base there. They also got into a legal battle with the people that made AstroTurf. But a neat thing about Colt Stadium, once the Astros moved indoors and played in the dome for, 35 years, Colt Stadium actually sat out in the parking lot and rotted in the sun for, 10 or 12 years. It was used as a junkyard. It was used as a training site for the Astros players when they didn't step around rattlesnakes. Rattlesnakes took up residence inside the stadium. It was basically just left to rot up until, the late 70s, bits and pieces of it were disassembled and moved to Mexico. So there is a stadium in Mexico that is made up of a lot of the used parts of Colt Stadium. So it's an early form of recycling. So even though Colt Stadium was long gone in the terms and eyes and memories of baseball fans after the 1964 season, it still lives on in bits and pieces in Mexico, but also go online and just type in Houston Colt Stadium. You'll see some pretty neat pictures, some pretty neat stories, neat artifacts and relics that have been picked up over time. And there was one guy, I can't recall the name of the site, but somebody many, many years ago went out to the Colt Stadium site. This is like in the early 80s, I want to say, and still found some relics just sitting there. Like I said, it was just part of it was a corner of the big Astro World parking lot for a long, long time, up until they opened up for Reliant Stadium, what was it, about 10 or 15 years ago. So a lot of neat history there, not only with the Houston Colt 45s and Colt Stadium, but shown right here in Rusty Staub's rookie card with the 1964 Topps card number 109. So if you have any thoughts about Rusty Staub, the Colts, the 64 Topps set, leave your comments at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. And don't forget, if you like what you hear on Wax Ecstatic, please find a dollar or two for the cost of a case of 88 Donruss cards. Yes, just a dollar or two. You can keep Wax Ecstatic going. You can send it to us via our tip jar at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Next Tuesday, after we have a Flashback Friday show, next Tuesday we will have a look at one of my favorite card sets of all time. And I'm still debating, is it my favorite of all time? There's still a couple sets that are in the race there, but I have always had a soft spot for 65 Tops, and a lot of collectors still do. And if you don't yet, you will after you hear our podcast and our random poll that's coming next Tuesday via Audioboom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, and Stitcher. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.